Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington. Here are some of the stories we're covering today, Friday, December 27th, 2019. Another large oil spill is reported in former Unity State.
The fire started at 2 p.m. We saw that it started where people were cutting trees for burning charcoal, and it started going toward the oil pipeline.
And how has violence in a neighboring country affected efforts to control an Ebola outbreak?
Of the violence, we cannot operate in the actual what we call hotspot, where we still have active transmission on cases.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Residents and government officials say yet another oil spill in South Sudan's former Unity State has caused serious environmental damage in that area. Residents and officials say they're concerned about oil companies' failure to detect oil spills when they happen, not to mention the company's inability to put out fires that are suspected of being started by local charcoal makers. Dimo Silva Aurelio reports for VOA from Juba.
Residents say an oil spill at Kaloi, located about 10 kilometers west of Unity Oil Field, owned and operated by the Chinese Greater Pioneer Operating Company, caught fire last Saturday and continued burning for 2 days, sending thick plumes of smoke into the air. The fire could have accidentally started by local charcoal makers. To make charcoal, residents cut down trees, pile them in a heap, then cover the pile with grass and soil, then set it on fire. After burning for 4 to 5 days, the burnt wood turns into charcoal. Kaloi resident Kai Pan suspects locals torch off the fire. Speaking in Arabic, he describes what happened.
The fire started at 2 p.m. We saw that it started where people were cutting trees for burning charcoal, and it started going toward the oil pipeline, which is just 10 kilometers from Bintiu oil camp.
Pan says after the fire broke out, cases of airborne diseases suspected of being caused by dangerous oil fumes were reported in the area.
People are now coughing, a lot of coughing in this area. And also there are some skin problems and also eyes pain among residents of this area.
Pan says oil spills are still in the surrounding areas of Kaloi, posing a threat to the community. Dr. Duol Bim, Director General at the Northern Liechi State Health Ministry, says oil companies operating in South Sudan do not follow international safety procedures to handle oil spills in South Sudan.
They don't have fire trucks, they don't have fire extinguishers, they have nothing. Okay? They went there, they could not do anything to make sure that the fire is contained. Okay? It was just left like that. It continued burning for 2 days.
Bim says the Chinese company, Jipok, not only failed to contain the fire, but did not detect the leakage until several days later.
Here, in this case, there is negligence on the side of the oil company that is in the area. Because if leakages are happening and they are not being detected on time, this shows that the oil company in the area is not doing a good job, okay? Because it is their responsibility to ensure that leakages are detected on time, they are reported on time and contained on time.
Bim says while a previous oil leak in the Budang area of former Unity State was detected by a soldier who was hunting for wild fruits, this spill was only detected after the oil caught fire. He says oil exploration companies should educate local residents about the dangers of charcoal making near oil manufacturing so that they don't start fires near such facilities.
They are not aware. Okay, these are people who are doing their normal activities. Accidentally, I think the crude oil caught fire. It is not something intentional. Okay, this is something dangerous. Even the locals, they know crude oil is very dangerous when it catches fire. We know this.
South Sudan Petroleum Minister Awoh Daniel Chuang was not available for comment. His phone was switched off. In November, Chuang warned that more oil spills were likely to happen given that pipelines used to transport South Sudanese crude are old and could have rusted. For VOA News, I am Dimo Silva Aurelio in Juba.
In the neighboring Democratic Republic of Congo, national and international health experts have battled an outbreak of Ebola for nearly 18 months now. This year, new vaccines and new treatments for those infected have saved countless lives. But violence from regional militias has forced many health workers to leave the region after several were killed or injured in attacks on health facilities. Dr. Michel Yao leads the World Health Organization's Ebola team in the DRC. He recently spoke with my colleague Kate Pound Dawson about the gains and the reverses seen this year.
Actually, based on lessons learned the West African outbreak, it was agreed that some of the research that can be technically sound and as well as ethically clear could be conducted. So in this outbreak, while responding at the middle of the response, we were also undertaking some research. So the first one is a vaccine that was used, we call it a compassionate use of vaccine. And actually, this vaccine was at the results so far show that the vaccine is quite effective. It's actually one of the most effective, and it helped us actually to contain the disease within the province and to reduce contamination of neighboring countries. So it's actually one of the big achievements. The second innovation is we were using investigational Ebola treatment drugs. At the beginning, we were using four, but from the results we had, the two of them have been shown quite effective.
Now, you've had these very good scientific and medical gains, but the security situation there in DRC is complicating the effort. Can you talk about the problem there?
Actually, we were quite close to the control of this outbreak in November. We were having less than 10 cases a week. If we compare to what we had earlier in the first quarter of the month, where we reached 100 cases per week, so there was a lot of achievement. But unfortunately, with the violence, we cannot operate in the actual what we call hotspot, where we still have active transmission on cases. Because it's really unacceptable that people trying to save others give their life. We are trying to resume because we cannot afford to totally stop the response. We have relocated some of our staff, and we are trying to work remotely with local staff, trying to coach them, and we are also strengthening security measures, at least to increase access.
In the coming year, what is going to be needed to fully contain this outbreak, to put it to bring it to a halt?
So the main thing, critical thing that needs to be done is to secure all this area for the Ebola team to be able to work, and we may not be far from controlling this outbreak. So if access can be granted, I think we have enough resources, enough knowledge, enough capacity on the ground to deal with this outbreak.
That was Dr. Michel Yao with the WHO in Goma, DRC. He was speaking with VOA's Kate Pound Dawson. Police in Botswana say reported incidents of rape have nearly doubled in the past year. Activists say successful anti-rape campaigns have made victims more confident about reporting when they are attacked. But the higher recorded levels of rape also have spurred activists in Botswana to demand more action against sexual assault, as Mukandise Dube reports from Gaborone.
32-year-old Mpho Modise, not her real name, was attacked and raped by two men while walking home earlier this year.
Even now, the thing is still on me. Sometimes I try to forget about it, but by the time it comes to my mind, I feel the pain. I tried to look for people to counsel me, but still, the pain is still on me.
Police say there were 1,600 reported cases of rape in the first three quarters of 2019, almost double compared to that period for each of the previous 2 years. Activists like Desmond Lunga of Men and Boys for Gender Equality say the increase is due to victims feeling more comfortable about reporting attacks due to increased campaigning against rape.
And the first thing that we have been doing as activists is, one, to encourage people to report. So there's been a lot of rape that has been happening, but people have not been reporting. So one, as we see the numbers increasing, sometimes it's also a light to say people are seeing this and are able to go and report.
Despite this trend, social worker Komotso Jongmen says rape remains difficult to deal with due to the fact that in most cases the perpetrator is known to the victim.
Majority of the people who were raped by the family members or people closer to the family or the people that they know. That is something that I found very strange and very disturbing.
Lorato Mwalusi of the Botswana Gender-Based Violence Prevention and Support Center says more research is needed on the causes behind the widespread sexual assaults.
The scourge of rape, it's very high. Botswana has done very well in terms of trying to control HIV. But if we are not going to try and control the sexual violence, we are going to lose all the gains that we made. The silence must be broken. The silence is too loud.
Botswana's vulnerable are hoping that more accurate rape statistics will spur the nation to take more action. Mkondisi Dube for VOA News, Haburoni.
You're tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. The 2020 World Gender Gap Report is out. Find out how African countries are ranked when we come back.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
what is your favorite way to celebrate?
More of meditation. I thank my God, and that is it. I'm not the type that calls, you know, for fanfare. You know, the way in which, you know, I celebrate is in a calm way, you know, in a very quiet way, and that's how I get my own happiness.
Take a leave. Even if it's for a date, I can just decide to just, you know, leave my house, take a relaxation day in the hotel.
I love singing, so when I'm happy with something, I'll definitely going to sing. I'll either sing a favorite song or either sing a spiritual song, but I'm going to sing, whether I'll sing in the bathroom, whether I'll sing in the car.
A free meal on me, on the house. Or a beer. Yeah, because this is something anyone would love.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
South Sudan in Focus is now on WhatsApp. Send us a message on +1 202 630 8011. Tell us what's happening in your area or give us your feedback on the stories you hear on South Sudan in Focus. We look forward to hearing from you on WhatsApp. That number again, +1 202 630 8011.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. The 2020 Gender Gap Report from the World Economic Forum ranks Rwanda 9th globally in promoting equality for women. Recently, Rwandan President Paul Kagame said he wants to be replaced by a woman when his tenure ends in 2024 to keep fostering gender parity in that country. Eugene Uwimani has more from Kigali.
The report puts Rwanda between Spain at 8th place and Germany in the 10th spot in promoting women worldwide. No other African nation is in the top 10. Rwanda's government has made steady efforts to make women's voices heard. Paul Kagame is the country's president.
The fight for gender equality is really common sense. Women are our mothers, sisters, and wives, and daughters. Whatever women gain, everybody gains and nobody loses.
However, many gender activists say there is still a long way to go to protect and promote women. Olivo Maria is a gender activist working with the organization CARE International.
We know that there are so many women who are living in violence, women who don't have access to the opportunities that are out there. And simply because they don't have the capacities, the power within, to understand that you have the voice, you matter, it can be possible.
In Uganda's national dialogue, which concluded last Friday, Kagame endorsed the idea of a woman leading the country. Kagame says he wishes at the end of his tenure, his position can be taken by a woman. He says he hopes that is what men here want to. The World Economic Forum reports that in the past 50 years, 85 states have had no female head of state, and it says in terms of economic participation, the gender gap will take 257 years to close. According to the report, there are 72 countries where women are barred from opening bank accounts or obtaining credit. For Akinwumi Adesina, president of the African Development Bank, this is an issue that they are tackling.
A world that denies women the opportunities to excel is not a smart world. A world led by women will never have wars. Life bearers will never become life takers.
According to the World Economic Forum, it will take 95 years at the current rate to close the worldwide gender gap in political representation. The journey should not be that long for Rwanda. Today, women hold more than half of Rwanda's ministerial positions and more than 60% of the seats in the parliament. 4 of 7 Supreme Court judges are women. Eugene Uwimana for VOA News, Kigali, Rwanda.
The International Organization for Migration, or IOM, says more than 35,500 Ghanaians are in Libya, having gone there on their way to their final destination, which is Europe. But many now want to return home. Mavis Ochieri in Ghana has more.
There are more than 650,000 illegal migrants in Libya, about 6,000 of them rescued at sea or arrested by Libyan security forces are in crowded detention centers, the International Organization for Migration reports. The migrants, mostly Africans, attempt to cross the Mediterranean Sea to Europe from Libya. Since May 2017, the IOM has helped more than 1,260 migrants voluntarily return to Ghana and reintegrate into their communities. Kim Florence is the IOM spokesperson for Western Central Africa based in Dakar, Senegal. She says for the past year, the UN agency has seen a dramatic decrease in the number of migrants arriving from West Africa seeking to reach Italy through Libya. IOM data show that this year 11,000 migrants reached Italy through Libya, compared with more than 100,000 a few years ago. Florence says since 2014, more than 200,000 people have died in the Mediterranean Sea trying to reach Europe. This year, just under 800 people died, the lowest number in several years. Florence says despite the falling death toll, the migration flow remains a humanitarian issue that needs all stakeholders to address.
All the awareness raising, all the information that we are trying to spread across West Africa are actually working. We have more and more returned migrants who are actually less ashamed to share their own stories, to share their experience, to talk about the unspeakable abuses they actually faced along their journey. So I think, and we are also trying to involve as much as possible all the traditional leaders, all the local authorities and goodwill ambassadors to actually talk and explain what's going on. So this is also a factor explaining the fact that less and less people are actually leaving Libya to Italy and they rather return home.
Florence says West African governments, the families of migrants, the United Nations aid group and the migrants themselves share the responsibility for addressing illegal migration to Libya. Even the news media have a role, she says, by reporting the stories of returnees. She called for governments in West Africa with support from UN agencies to put the right structures in place so that the youth can hope in their future in their home countries. She called for governments in West Africa with support from UN agencies to put the right structures in place so that the youth can hope in their future in their countries.
The governments are seeing their youth leaving, but the youth is actually the future of the economies, of the development of these countries. So it's for the benefit of all that we make sure that these youth, these African youth, West African youth, Ghanaian youth, is actually aware of the local opportunities at home. And if they don't want to stay, actually that they are aware of the legal pathways to migrate.
Florence says IOM programs are reaching about 200,000 people in Ghana. Some programs help returning migrants reintegrate and others work to reduce illegal migration to the barest minimum. She also encourages societies to stop stigmatizing returned migrants. Instead, they should be listened to because the returnees can help keep people from taking dangerous illegal migration routes. Reporting for VOA, this is Mavis Autry in Ghana.
In Kenya, the opuntia cactus, also known as the prickly pear, is spreading, destroying thousands of acres of grassland and making animals that eat it sick. Kenyans have come up with a variety of methods to try to eradicate the problem plant, including breeding a microorganism that feeds on the cactus. They're also looking at ways to turn it into food for humans. Mohammed Yusuf reports from Ipole, Kenya.
In central Kenya, locals say people are being driven away from their homes by a cactus.
Many people have moved out because their goats and cattle are dying. The people of Ilpoloy and Munishoy are fleeing to other places. Many have left.
The opuntia cactus has spread like a weed, killing off thousands of acres of grassland. Rancher Margaret Mamai says it has destroyed her livelihood.
If goats eat the cactus and its fruit, their eyes and mouth are affected. The most affected one is sheep. If it eats the cactus, there is no treatment. It dies. Now there is no place for them to graze.
Mamai is fighting back by breeding microorganisms that feed on the cactus. But Kenyan authorities say they will need to use laboratories to produce the quantities required to wipe out the problem plant.
That's what we are lacking, to produce those microorganisms so that they can be spread all over for them to reduce the point. But it's a very slow method.
But it is not just microorganisms that can feed on the cactus. At this community center, the cactus fruit are crushed to make juice and wine. The seeds are dried and the oil is extracted for making cosmetics.
The health of human beings is good. The only problem is for the animals, the spines. It's stuck in the animals. But for the juice and the fruit, you can also eat the fruit. Good for human use.
But getting enough consumers to see the cactus as a food source is a challenge. Meanwhile, for ranchers like Mamai, the opuntia is simply a way to be destroyed. Mohammed Yusuf for VOA News, Ilpoloi, Kenya.
Basketball originated in the U.S., but it's increasingly become a game that Africa and much of the world has come to love. Since 2010, the U.S. National Basketball Association, or NBA, has been developing the Basketball Africa League on the continent. Its first pro season starts in a few months. For years, the NBA has also conducted grassroots basketball programs for young people as a way to develop a fan base and offer team sportsmanship for kids, as well as provide opportunity for a future with the game. The new Africa League was in New York recently to showcase its talent, and that's where VOA's Adam Phillips interviewed Dawn Smythe, the NBA's international grassroots lead in Africa.
My passion around it is impacting people's first kind of few touches with the game, whether it's a player, a fan, an adult league, you know, pick up a ball, go outside. That's what we try to do to grow the game, to provide opportunities for those to play, but also to continue with the love of basketball.
You say get them involved, but how do you get them involved? I'm thinking especially of young ones who might otherwise be drawn foursquare into the world of football, or soccer as we call it here in the U.S.
So we've got sort of a list of junior MBA programs that are designed to fit for the region, because again, with so much diversity in the world, you want to make sure that you're bringing basketball to how it fits with the people that are in the country. And so in Africa, I've got leagues throughout Africa, and so it's starting to create some initial competition structure for the young kids. So under 18, under 16, under 14, for them to get into competition and play. A kid with their school will join into a junior NBA league, and they'll play against other schools locally. We often do drafts at the beginning. Sometimes, depending on the region, we'll put it like a skills competition in there where they get to try, you know, five different skills, and we take some of those skills competitions and go to their own courts and practice that. You know, competing against yourself. Like when they see the competition again next year, it's like, have I improved? And then, you know, it kind of finishes with the finals. So it mimics a full NBA season. So they're great fans in the NBA games, but then also to get to experience the game as a player.
It's very interesting balance from the NBA's point of view. On the one hand, you want to encourage a love of basketball in Africa. It's good to develop fans for business purposes, market development, etc. It's not that these kids are losers if they don't make it into the NBA or the BAL. But at the same time, you do want to identify and develop great talent at the grassroots, possibly for the real big time. What's your view of that?
You know, we've got a great department that does talented identification, and I think the one thing about talent is it shows up along a pathway. So it's not like nine-year-olds, it's the time that you have to be identified. You could actually be identified later. Like late developers tend to get picked up a little bit later in their pathway. So, you know, you want to make sure there's a place for everyone to play until they're identified. And when they stop playing, and if they're not identified, that there's so many different places in sport administration or the game itself, like refereeing and coaching and league organizers, that there's so many places for people outside of the 1% that move on to like a pro career or an NBA career.
I know the newly created Basketball Africa League is a big part of all this for the NBA, both as a place for talent as well as for some great careers off the court.
Yeah, great question. Two things. One, I think with the Ball League, it's obviously extremely exciting. I think it creates role models for these youth in the leagues. You know, where can I go? What can I do? So they can see their own pathway and their own future, and it's so impactful. But as we're building competition, it's equally important to build coaching education and referee education. We never want the athletes to get so good that the coaches don't have the technical knowledge and don't have the education to support their development, and that the referees continue to grow and we support them such that they can referee the competition. So there's lots of room for everybody.
You sound so excited. Tell me, what's your biggest gratification in all this? I mean, like, what has turned you on about it?
For me, I love the different cultures coming together under the one game. So I think it's like everyone's got different languages, different cultures day to day. However, when you bring the basketball out, everyone does the same dribbling, everyone does the same shooting, and so it becomes like a language of basketball, a culture of basketball. And so what's really cool in this position is working with the globe, the world, speaking and communicating and being about this one culture and the one language while embracing everybody's individuality. And so, like, for me, it's got to be one of the coolest things.
And that was John Smythe, the international grassroots lead for the NBA, speaking with my colleague Adam Phillips in New York. That's our show for this Friday. We leave you with the song Panda by Saman Yuan Yak.
Kangon,
We've been listening to Simon Yuan Yap with the song Panda. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington. We appreciate you tuning us in this evening. Have a terrific weekend, everybody. Join us again on Monday for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
Ye doi don yo ya pu pange pan ye pingren men bil pam gan pu ye pingren men bil pam gan